I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink, a company that makes robots for the manufacturing industry. Rethink's first robot was introduced in 2012 and is named Baxter. In 1990, Dr. Brooks founded iRobot, which makes robots for the consumer and defense industries. iRobot's first consumer product was the Roomba, a vacuum robot introduced in 2002. The company went public in 2005 and is headquartered outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Brooks was formerly on the faculty at MIT from 1984 to 2010. His influential paper, entitled Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, was the inspiration for the Errol Morris documentary of the same name in 1997, in which Dr. Brooks is featured. Welcome.
Thanks for having me here.
Could you please define what a robot is?
Well, it's a bit like trying to define what art is, but I use the definition the robot is something that senses the world, does some computation, and then decides to act outside the extent of its own body. And I say outside the extent of its own body because I can't stand the thought of a dishwashing machine being a robot. It's not intelligent enough to me.
In 1990, you started your first robot company called iRobot with the intention to produce practical robots. What did you intend to build and to bring out to the market when you first launched the company?
When we first launched the company, we really didn't know. We were a bit naive, more than a bit naive. We knew we had technology to make robots mobile and move around, and we thought, well, everyone's going to like this technology. We'll just start a company. We've got a list of 14 failed business models we went through before we finally got the Roomba in 2002 and the military robots at the same time, and then we went public in 2005. But we had 14 failed business models, which weren't all bad models, just the world wasn't quite ready for some of them.
And what's one example of a model that the world wasn't ready for?
Well, one example was we were doing nuclear power plant inspection robots with the Japanese government, funded by MITI, Ministry of International Trade and Industry, partnered with Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. We did the research. We couldn't get traction for it to be a product until March of 2011, 1 week after the disaster, the Japanese government called iRobot. I was still on the board at that time, and said, please send some robots to Japan.
So instead of launching with a nuclear power plant robot, you launched with a vacuum cleaner. How did that happen?
Well, we had 14 models that we'd looked at, 14 different sorts of products. And all along, people said, well, I'd like a robot to clean my home. Back in 1990 or 1991 at my lab at MIT, we'd actually built a prototype vacuum cleaning robot. It wasn't very good. So eventually, towards the end of the 1990s, where we had learned to do low-cost manufacturing in China because we'd been doing toy robots for a while, we decided to have another go at building a vacuum cleaning robot. It wasn't the first vacuum cleaning robot on the market. The first one was from Electrolux for 2,000 euros in Europe. The key decision we made was we figured out that $200 was a price point that a person could spend without getting their spouse's approval. And so that became the target. The first model was $199.99,
wow.
September 18th, 2002.
You've said before that the robotic revolution parallels the PC revolution, and you've mentioned that when computers started to become more pervasive, they found their ways in toys and games initially before becoming more robust and complicated. Similarly, it seems like the Trojan horse for robots is also in toys and games and vacuums.
Yeah, well, in terms of the absolute number of robots, vacuum cleaning robots are more than any other sort of robot by far in the world. Industrial robots that are currently in factories really, to me, are like the mainframes of 30 years ago. Ordinary people can't touch them because they're dangerous. They're very hard to program. And then the PC came along around 1980, and slowly it started to get into offices, and ordinary office workers got to control computation. And the spreadsheet was the first killer app, if you like, where ordinary people could program the computer without having to be programmers.
So
we're trying to do the similar sort of thing for industrial robots, that ordinary factory workers can learn in minutes how to get it to do new tasks.
just as the PC did not replace the human being and made the human being more ostensibly efficient, your claim with Rethink is that these robots from manufacturing are also assisting the human rather than replacing the
human. Very much so. I we didn't get rid of office workers. There's lots of office workers around. Now, the tasks that office workers do are very different from the tasks they did 30 years ago. They're much more empowered. And so I see a similar sort of thing with these industrial robots.
Could you walk through some of the other examples of robots that you've built? On the military side, you have these small unmanned ground vehicles that were launched in Afghanistan, for example. What other applications are there of these robots?
We built a lot of custom robots over time. We built some for NASA for experiments with Mars rovers to develop the software for exploring Mars. We built a robot for National Geographic that went into the Great Pyramid and crawled up a little tiny tunnel and cut a hole through to a cavity that was known to be behind there. It was very small, just diameter of the tunnel was just a few inches, so a person couldn't get up there. Then the robot drilled a hole through to see what was inside this cavity, and there was nothing there.
And when you were starting the company and you were seeking venture capital, I mean, this is the nascent stages of the robotics industry. What did that landscape look like?
Well, we didn't actually go after venture capital in 1990. It was totally self-funded, and we would get contracts and ask for half the money up front because we had to float, you know, our payroll. In fact, for the first 8 or 9 years, we never knew that we were going to make payroll at the end of the month. We always did, though.
Hmm.
So it wasn't until 1998 that we started getting venture capital. It was 1998. It was boom times for the internet. I remember the most depressing interchange was Colin, Helen, and I, the three co-founders, on an August afternoon. It was hot. We were sweaty. We go into this one place, and they send out a summer intern, a junior in college, to talk to us. We start telling him what we're doing, and a few minutes in, he looks at us. He says, "You mean you build stuff? No one builds stuff anymore." And that was the end. So, in fact, I went off and started my own venture fund. Got some money from some Swiss pension funds and started a little venture fund with some people I knew called Robotic Ventures. And we did a few investments, but I realized I wasn't very good at being a venture capitalist. We did fine, but, you know, I like pushing the boundaries of things that are almost impossible. And the role of a venture capitalist is to put discipline on the entrepreneur. And I was just the opposite.
And then fast forward to 2008, when you founded Rethink Robotics, you had an easier time raising capital after the success of iRobot. You and Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, were the early investors.
Yeah, when I founded Rethink Robotics, it was very much going to be a venture-based company. I put in some money, and Jeff Bezos' personal investment vehicle put in the other money for the very first Series A1, as we came to call it.
How did you meet Jeff?
Well, I met Jeff a long time ago. I first met him at TED, Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference, and he was actually an investor in iRobot before it went public.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink Robotics, a company that produces robots for the manufacturing industry. Dr. Brooks is professor emeritus at MIT. What was the catalyst for leaving iRobot and going to Rethink? I know that they are focused on different industries, but were there any pivot moments for you?
Well, I had spent from 1997, I'd been going to China to learn to do low-cost manufacturing. I came to realize that was not going to be sustainable in the long term, that costs were going up in China. Even in the late 90s, if you were doing sewing for toys, that had already moved to Vietnam. So I could see sort of the writing on the wall. I sort of saw that people would want to do more manufacturing back in the United States. Had to be more productive. So I, being a robot guy, my answer was, let's have robots for manufacturing. But then people asked me, why didn't I do it inside iRobot? iRobot was sitting on a lot of cash, well over $100 million at the time I started Rethink Robotics. But if they spend that cash on a long-term development program, it comes off the bottom line. And Wall Street would slap them. So I presented the idea to the board, and as I expected, the board said, no, we can't spend our cash on that. I was under all sorts of agreements with them. They got equity in Rethink Robotics in return for releasing me from some of those agreements and got outside capital to start Rethink Robotics.
Now, Baxter's the name of the robot that you've launched. It costs $22,000. What does Baxter look like?
Well, Baxter's red and black. It has humanoid form. It has two arms. It has a LCD screen where the face would be, and normally there are eyes animated on that face, and the face always points towards any person who's nearby the robot. And when it's about to reach for something, the eyes glance at where it's about to reach. So if you're working in close proximity to it, it doesn't surprise you with an unexpected motion. It's a bit bigger than a human being. We tried to have it have human reach, but it doesn't have any hips, so we had to make longer arms. So I say it's like an Olympic swimmer is the size of the arms.
You mentioned Baxter's eyes. Are they functional or more social so that people interact with him as if he were a human being?
Yeah, we call Baxter an it because I try to make my robots deliver on any promise they give in their appearance. And I don't know what to promise in terms of gender, so I always call them its. The eyes... There is a camera right above the LCD screen, so it is actually seeing. But the animated eyes are really to give a person an understanding of what the robot is paying attention to.
Just on the subject of humanoid robots, what are the benefits of creating a robot that looks human-like?
Well, actually, when I started Rethink Robotics, I didn't believe we were going to build a humanoid robot. That was not the original intent. But over time, as we talked to many potential customers, a lot of them said they wanted to be able to replace the robot with a person. So that if the robot went down, they could just get a person in to take over temporarily so it didn't slow things down. Hmm. So they wanted the reliability of replacing with a person. And that led us to build a robot with human-like capabilities in terms of what sort of things it could lift up, 5 pounds at full extension, and how fast it could move.
I've read before that one potential disadvantage of making a robot too human-like is that people might have disproportionate expectations of what it could do. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So, I say that if you make your robot look just like Albert Einstein, it better be as smart as Albert Einstein, or otherwise people are going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. So we tried to make Baxter look up, have the appearance of about how smart it is, which is not really very smart.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the roboticist, Dr. Rodney Brooks. We'll hear more from Dr. Brooks coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink, a company that makes robots for the manufacturing industry. In 1990, Dr. Brooks founded iRobot, which makes robots for the consumer and defense industries. iRobot's first consumer product was the Roomba, a vacuum robot introduced in 2002. Dr. Brooks was formerly on the faculty at MIT from 1984 to 2010. I've heard you say before there are four things needed to solve issues with robotics. Do you want to tell what they are?
So I've been telling people in research for a while that there are four aspirational goals. If we make improvement in any of these four, just improvement, the robots will get a lot better. So the first thing is the visual capabilities of a two-year-old child. A two-year-old child, you can show them objects. You can show them a pair of glasses. They'll tell you it's glasses. You can show them a set of keys that they've never seen before. They'll tell you it's a set of keys. So getting to visual object identification capabilities of a two-year-old child. The language capabilities of a four-year-old child. A four-year-old child can understand accents. You don't have to dumb down the grammar. They may not know all the words, but they're learning words at an incredible rate. They understand questions. They understand conditionals. They understand a bunch of stuff at age four. At age six, the manual dexterity of a six-year-old child. A six-year-old child can tie shoelaces. A six-year-old child can do any task that is asked of a Chinese factory worker. They have that dexterity. They may not be able to play Chopin on the piano, but they've got the dexterity to do any sort of cooking task, any sort of task in the house. if they're so inclined. And the last one is the social understanding of an 8-year-old child. It's really a 9-year-old child, but I say 8 to make it a even pattern, where an 8 or 9-year-old child understands that a person different from them has a different understanding of the world, and they can reason about what that person knows because of what that person has been exposed to and seen in the world, and they don't make the mistake of thinking that everyone has the same model of the world as they do. If we had all those 4 capabilities, we would have the, you know, robots beyond my imagination.
And if this ideal robot were achieved, could the robot mature to be an older humanoid, you know, individual through pattern recognition and repetition, just as humans could?
It may. You know, our robot, even Baxter, does some sort of learning. But learning is such a loaded term because when human learning is so rich. So I didn't ask for the richness of human-level learning in those 4 capabilities. I was trying to make pretty much a robot that's a useful tool.
How much has your understanding of human behavior and the chemistry of the human body, how much have you had to enrich your understanding of those systems, even the spiritual life and the physical life of a human being, to help you in your robotic work?
During the 90s, my students and I at MIT really looked at child development a lot as inspiration for how to build the subsystems that could make up a robot that was adaptable to the world. Mm-hmm. And so that inspired us in trying to understand what software modules we needed to build to process sensory information and to control dexterous actuation.
You are considered a pioneer in the field of behavior-based robotics. And essentially, you advocate using decentralized systems to create robots rather than a centralized system. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, and I'll tell you how it fits in the Baxter context, actually. So you could have a top-down planning system where the wanted the robot to do some task and it would plan out ahead of time every single step and then follow that plan. And a lot of traditional AI, artificial intelligence, tries to do that. Baxter has lots of little behaviors that run in parallel. So, for instance, its arms will not collide with each other. If you try to bring them close together, they'll push each other away. It knows, a little rule knows, that it can't put something down unless it has something in its hand. So it has lots of little simple rules like that, which make it adaptable to a changing environment because it's not pre-computing exactly what it's going to do ahead of time. It's reacting to what's in the environment through many, many parallel, simple little behaviors.
Why did you pioneer this shift from centralized, you know, robotics to decentralized system? What do you see as the advantage?
Well, back in the 1980s, I was looking at trying to make robots navigate around in the world, and the computations were getting more and more complex. And I looked at little insects, and little insects with just 100,000 neurons were able to fly around and do all sorts of things we couldn't make a robot do with a big mainframe computer. So I realized there had to be a different way of organizing things.
In addition to studying childhood development to better inform your work, have you also thought, you know, just on a larger scale about, like, what human beings are? Like, what is your view of human life?
So I, for a long time, I was confused by how someone could be both a scientist and be religious. It didn't make sense to me. I'm an atheist. And then I realized that in my own life, I had a duality of interpretations of the world. So if I look at carefully at a person, they're a big bag of skin full of biomolecules, which operate according to rules and are predictable in a sense. But my own children, I love unconditionally. I don't treat them as bags of skin full of biomolecules. I have 2 different ways of being in the world. I have the scientist way and the father way. And so I realize that we all have multiple views of the world, which we use at different times, and we're actually pretty comfortable about holding mutually inconsistent sets of belief. So, yes, I think we are all robotic, chemical robots. That is what we human beings are. And by the way, all of modern science actually believes that. It's all about van der Waals forces and things like that. But people then have a different view of humans, which can be very spiritual or very religious.
Now, you know, your view of humans being chemical robots, you know, might not sit well with some people. And I've heard you say before how it's been hard for society to some extent to accept our lack of specialness. You know, we started off thinking we were the center of the universe and the sun revolved around us. And then
God had made the earth for us because we were the peak of creation. And the one that really got it for me was Garry Kasparov. Garry Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue, the world chess champion. Garry is a very sweet guy. I met him just a few months ago. But when he was beaten by Deep Blue in the 90s, the IBM supercomputer that beat him at chess, when he was beaten, he got up and he said, well, at least it didn't enjoy beating me. Because he still had the specialness that he had emotions, but the computer didn't have emotions. So, and I realize we're always trying to be special. We want to be special.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink Robots, a company that produces robots for the manufacturing industry. Dr. Brooks is a professor emeritus at MIT. Incidentally, you mentioned you have children. You have four children. Are any of them in the field of robotics? What do they do?
None of my four children are in robotics, but my youngest daughter is actually an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley making engineering toys for young girls.
I want to talk about your upbringing. You grew up in Adelaide, Australia. Your father was a telephone technician, and your mother was a hairdresser. You spent some time as a child tinkering with leftover rocket equipment. Your dad was initially a telephone technician, but then he worked in a testing facility to help Europe build its first satellite launch system. Can you describe some of those early moments?
I actually had a book, the How and Why Wonder Book of Electricity, and another book, The How and Why Wonder Book of Computers and Giant Brains. And I got them when I was about 7 years old. They were American books. And they just gave a little bit enough information for me to start building simple circuits. And for some reason, I wanted to build intelligent systems. So when I was about 7 or 8, I built a computer, I called it, which was made out of nails and light bulbs out of flashlights and batteries and wires, which could play a very simple game where you took turns in taking away between 1 and 4 matches from a pile, and whoever ended up with the last match lost or won or something. And I built a circuit that could play that. And then I really worked hard. And by the time I was 12, getting a little more sophisticated switches out of old office switchboards as surplus equipment, I was able to build a computer, as I called it, which could play tic-tac-toe and not be beaten. And I wanted to build robots, but I wasn't dexterous enough to get things that could actually mechanically move. I could build circuits, but it wasn't until I was around 15 or 16 that I built my first robot.
And, you know, so you built your first simple circuit computer at 7 or 8 years old. Were your parents like, oh, that's nice, okay, come in for dinner?
Or... Well, actually, it was a little weird in that. I wasn't allowed to do it during the week because I had to watch TV like a normal kid. And on the weekends, I wasn't allowed to stay out in the lab, which was in a shed in the back garden, past 5 p.m. So I had to learn how to be – I'd think all week what I was going to do on the weekend, what I was going to build, and then I'd get in there and go at it as quick as possible.
Now, you were one of four children. Did your siblings participate in this?
My older brother had a chemistry set and in the same back garden shed, but no, they were not as dedicated to this as I was. I was an anomaly. In fact, my mother finished 10th grade, my father finished 9th grade, and at age 4, everyone called me the professor because somehow I was weird from birth.
You call it weird, but did you have a sense of self and, you know, continued confidence to say, okay, I am smart? Like,
well, I could do things, mental arithmetic in my head. I don't know what it was, except by age 4, I knew that I was better at computation, arithmetic, than any adult. It was just something, a gift. It was something in me.
Now, there was one computer in Adelaide, Australia, and you had exposure to it.
When I was younger, there was an IBM computer mainframe in the city that you could see through a glass wall, and I would go and look at that. By the time I got to be an undergraduate at one of the local universities.
Flinders.
Flinders University. They had a 16 kilobyte computer with four full-time operators running it during the week. And you could punch your cards, submit them, and 24 hours later you'd get your printout. But one of the professors really understood that maybe I, you know, had a lot of interest in this, and he arranged that over the weekend I was allowed to use that computer by myself for 12 hours every Sunday. So from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Sundays, I had that computer with one other student, and I got to recreate and learn computer science myself. There was no computer science being taught, but I got to learn it and figure it out for myself.
Now, you were so focused on, you know, math and arithmetic and computers and artificial intelligence at the time. How about your social life, your social development? Did you have girlfriends? And
I wasn't real good with girlfriends, but I did play various sports and went to parties.
You made your way to the United States. Initially, you went to Stanford and got a PhD at Stanford. How did being in the United States change possibilities for you,
if at all? I came to Stanford in 1977, and, you know, that was sort of the blooming of Silicon Valley. And I came from somewhere where there were almost no computers, and, you know, I would be in a McDonald's and hear people talking about software and programming at the next table. It was just such a different environment, and so I really was able to get immersed. I was able to, you know, go to Xerox Park and see the Alto at the same time that Steve Jobs was seeing the Alto and the mouse and the Windows.
The Alto being the...
The Alto was the computer built at Xerox Park and was what essentially Apple copied to make the Macintosh.
And after getting your PhD at Stanford, you ended up at MIT, but it took you a few years to finally become on the faculty. And you said, even despite your rejections, you just kept trying. And there's a quote you once said that rejection is not the end.
No, rejection is not the end. I did not get accepted to MIT as a graduate student. I applied for a faculty job there three times before I eventually got a faculty job. And the other rejection is I actually failed my qualifying exam at Stanford in artificial intelligence. First exam I'd ever failed in my life.
Why did you know upon taking the exam that, oh boy, I'm failing?
I did not know that. I had got there and I was full of confidence, and I just wasn't ready for the qualifying exam, so I failed.
When you finally did become professor at MIT in the 1980s, you developed various robots with students in your robotics lab, and eventually you met your iRobot co-founders, Colin Engel and Helen Greiner. By the way, I was surprised to see that one of your co-founders, Helen, is a woman. How many of your students are women?
I had 27 PhD students, and I believe that 10 or 11 of them were women. So I had a lot more women in my lab than most robotics labs.
Is that ratio roughly the norm?
It really occurred because I had one woman, Anita Flynn. She had actually been at the Naval Academy, was really strong, aggressive, and new leadership. And that made it safe for other women to come in and join the lab. And then it just became a tradition that women worked in my lab and more came.
You were a faculty member at MIT for a quarter of a century. And so you kind of had this hybrid life where you were on both sides, both, you know, the academic life, but also the business world. Did that ever create conflicts within the university? Because more and more you have these professors entering business.
Yeah, I was very careful to separate my two lives. So when we started iRobot, which was based on mobile robotics, I stopped doing mobile robot research and shifted to humanoid robot research because that was going to be a place that iRobot was never going to go. So my grad students would not be worried that what they were doing with me as a research project was somehow feeding into my company.
Here we are, you know, just at the beginning of the robot revolution where you saw PCs in the 1980s. Where do you see robots, let's say, 100 years from now?
I think robots are going to be pervasive, or robotic systems. Now, back in 1980, if you told people that they would have computers in their kitchens in the 1990s, they would have thought you were crazy. But instead, by the mid-1990s, there were computers, there were microprocessors in everyone's kitchen. So the robots that will appear in our world will not necessarily be the robots of science fiction or the robots of Hollywood, but robotic technology will be everywhere. So, for instance, Toyota, in their robot division, have recently announced a robot to help elderly people get into and out of bed. Doesn't look like a humanoid robot at all. It lets someone have a little more dignity and live at home longer, an elderly person, live at home longer because they can do stuff themselves with that robotic technology, which otherwise they would need people to help them get into and out of bed.
Your mother is still alive. Your father passed away. What does she think of what you've become?
She's very proud of me, but she doesn't really understand my life. In fact, most of my friends in Australia from those days don't understand the sort of life I have. You know, they'd be, what do you mean you only teach one course? Being at MIT is just a little part-time job. They didn't understand the idea of a major research university. So it's a very different life from what I came from.
Just in your practical daily life, what are your encounters with robots in your own home? That maybe have you created any for yourself to help you make cereal in the morning?
I don't have any special robots. I do have a scuba, the small scuba that cleans my bathroom floor, I was using Roombas for a while, but I must admit I have a cleaning service right now that comes in and does that. But the scuba keeps my bathroom floor very clean.
Is there anything else that you feel a pain point in your home? Like, oh, I'd love to have something that makes my bed.
No, I sleep in an unmade bed.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Rodney Brooks. Coming up, we'll meet the inventor Maurice Kanbar. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the inventor Maurice Kanbar. His creations include the Defuzzit sweater comb, which removes lint from sweaters, the Safety Glide hypodermic needle protector, an LED traffic light, and Sky Vodka, which he launched in 1993. Maurice also founded the Quad Cinemas in 1972, the first multiplex theater in New York City. And in 1997, he donated $5 million to NYU, creating the Maurice Kanbar Institute for Film and Television. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
You grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Yes.
What type of household did you grow up in?
It was a simple household, a mother, father, two brothers, and we certainly weren't rich, but of course I never went hungry. We had a 3-year-old Chevrolet in the driveway of a little house that we had, and, you know, my father worked hard. My mother was basically a housewife who cooked meals for us, and my first job was working as a delivery boy for a drugstore because I was small and slight and couldn't afford to carry the big packages at the AMP. And I can tell you this, that my bicycle was never locked and it was never stolen. It was a different world.
Now, you went to a yeshiva school in Brooklyn.
I did go. My parents sent me there because they thought I would get a good education, which, of course, they were right, even though they were not orthodox. I didn't like it at the time because we had to go at 8:30 in the morning till 4:30. Mm. The other kids were going from 9 to 3. Anyway, that's what happened there.
You've created more than 100 different objects or products, not all of which have gone to market. But at what point did you think, you know, I want to make a professional life out of making things?
Well, actually, I never really thought I would make a professional life out of it. I was very fortunate. I tell a story about my first real invention that made a lot of money, and I was wearing a sweater. My back was against a concrete wall, And then my college roommate pulled me away, and I turned and I felt something grab on my sweater, and I looked at the wall, and sure enough, there were three fuzz balls on the concrete. Anyway, I realized that it was the sand in the concrete, which is crystalline in nature, and these little crystals grabbed the fuzz balls and took it off, actually. I said, that's great. Anyway, to make a long story short, I bought some coarse fabric. I put some adhesive on it, and I sprinkled it with a sandpaper, a sand like sandpaper. Let it dry, and lo and behold, it worked beautifully in removing fuzz balls from sweaters. It also opened up a lot of the fuzz balls. Mm. So it's much better than shaving them off.
Now, this became the defuzz it sweater comb.
The defuzz it sweater comb.
Was this your first patent?
That was my first patent and my first moneymaker, and it was very successful.
How did you go about selling it?
Well, I didn't have much money at the time, a friend of mine had just lost his job, so I brought Malcolm into the picture. We went to the library. This was before Google, you know. We went to the library and got the names of sweater departments in large department stores and all the Notions. In those days, there were a lot of Notions department that sold sewing and stuff like that and sold wool. So we made a package. A little brown envelope that I bought, and I put two defuzzed combs and a little note that we had printed by a local printer. And we said, please use the defuzzed. And if you like it as we do, you can order 6 dozen, three dozen, 6 dozen, 12 dozen. Here, the prices, blah, blah. And we got orders. In the first 12 months, if I remember correctly, we made $220,000, which in those days is the equivalent of $2 million today.
You grew up in New York City, and now you live in San Francisco, where you have a 10,000 square foot warehouse, essentially, which is the home of most of your creations. Before you moved to San Francisco, you also dabbled in the film world. You developed, almost by accident, the first multiplex in New York City.
I believe it was the first multiplex, certainly on the East Coast. Mm. I don't know of any other multiplex.
How did you come to create this multiplex? And it's called the Quad Cinemas.
I love movies, okay? And so I go to the movies, and we're having dinner, and somebody was complaining who owned some theaters in Chicago was complaining they were losing money. People don't go to the movies. They all watch television. And this was 1972, and it really affected the movie business. And here I was in a 1,500-seat house, and I counted the house. There were 120 people. So I said to myself, I could build 450-seat houses in this location that I have. And if 100 people show up for each film, I'm doing fine. Mm-hmm. So to make a long story short, I built the theaters, and we were profitable the first month.
How did you come to own the building?
Well, a friend of mine who wanted to build a off-Broadway theater in this building said to me, would you please buy this building? I will rent it. So I said, okay. I said, and I love theater, so I said, fine. So I bought the building, and it turns out he couldn't raise the money. So all of a sudden, I owned the building. He said, I'm so sorry. I said, God, what am I going to do with this building now, you know? And then I said, you know, let's build four little movie houses.
Now, this was in 1972. Where did you get the capital at this point to buy, you know, this building in New York City, for example? Which of your inventions created the most income for you?
Well, the defuzzet was making money, and I had one job in my life. It was selling DuPont fibers, and I got the idea that I can compete with DuPont in one little category, and which I finally did with great difficulty to raise the money. And 14 months after I set the plant to make nylon yarn, we sold it to then the largest hosiery company called Kaiser Roth. I didn't rush out and buy custom-made suits. I mean, I'm basically frugal. And then actually the Bankers Trust at that time lent me some money plus my own, and I was able to build it.
Now, you mentioned that you're frugal. You still clip coupons, and you drive around San Francisco on a scooter. To what extent is this part of this, depression mentality that you grew up in the 1930s?
I don't think it's so much a depression because I didn't suffer. I mean, you know, people standing online to get a bowl of soup, but I never had that problem. Let me say this. I don't like waste. It's part of the way you brought up. You're brought up to be philanthropic. If you have more on your plate than you can eat, find someone who's hungry, you know?
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the inventor, Maurice Kambar. Some of his creations include the Safety Glide Hypodermic Needle Protector, a device for removing varicose veins, and Sky Vodka, which was sold to Campari International for over $400 million. The Safety Glide Hypodermic Needle Protector, what was the catalyst for that invention?
Well, I have a friend of mine who's a physician, and he told me that, this is about 10 years ago, he said, you know, last year there were 20,000 accidental needle sticks. And he said, you know, we have to invent something to protect these hospital workers and physicians from accidentally sticking themselves. And then flying to New York one day from San Francisco, I was looking out the window, and I said, wow, I got it. And I made it, made the model, it worked. And rather than, I'm not going to go into the hypodermic business, we licensed Becton Dickinson, the largest manufacturer of syringes in the world. And we've been making very substantial royalties. And my doctor friend gets a portion of that because he kept pushing me. And it's been terrific.
Your inventions are industry agnostic, you know, ranging from healthcare to alcohol to vodka. Yeah. And Sky, which you founded in 1993, has claimed to not cause hangovers because you remove the impurities called congeners in the distillation process. Could you explain that?
Well, when you ferment any carbohydrate, you get alcohol plus some ingredients that are naturally formed impurities that are called congeners. Now, these impurities are what gives the particular alcohol, like bourbon or cognac, its flavor. Now, in order to remove them, you have to distill at a very precise temperature to distill off the amyl alcohol, then another temperature to distill all the propyl alcohol. And you can do that and therefore purify the alcohol.
And at that point, once these congeners are removed, does the alcohol then become tasteless?
It becomes odorless and tasteless. That is correct. As a matter of fact, if I took cognac and distilled the congeners out, I would have vodka. These congeners impart a very interesting taste, okay? But for me, they imparted a headache. So I said, let's get those things out of there. I had a big problem getting distilleries to do 4 distillations. And they all thought I was a little crazy because they said, look, we've been making alcohol for 140 years. Nobody has asked us to distill 4 times. I said, well, I'm asking you to do that. No, it's a long story. They finally found somebody who would do it.
So here you are. You finally convinced a distiller to make this odorless alcohol without these impurities so that you wouldn't get a hangover. Then what?
The first hurdle that you have basically in any product that you'd like to sell is what are you going to call it? So my first name was, let's call it Prince Romanov Vodka. I'll have a Prince Romanov on the rocks. Didn't sound right. Well, how about Tsar Nikolai? That didn't sound right. I said, it's not going to be Russian. It will be made in this good old USA. So, Maurice, think about some other name. Okay. And a few months went by. I couldn't think of a name. One day I looked out my window, and there was a magnificent blue sky. And I said, oh, look at that. I said, that's the name Sky Vodka. I called up my patent attorney and told him to register the name. He said, how are you spelling it? I said, S-K-Y. He said, that's no good. I said, that's like air or water. Oh, I said, oh, God, it was a great name. And then to make a long story short, that was fortunate, added the other Y and gave it a distinct look and a great call because a person walks up and by and says, I have a Sky on the rocks, or give me a Sky Martini, or give me a Sky Driver. It was a great name.
And incidentally, it's also in this what's become this iconic blue bottle.
Well, it certainly gave it a distinction that no other vodka had because people say, what's in that blue bottle? Oh, that's Sky Vodka. Oh, let me try that. That was stuff that I created myself. I mean, I didn't have some marketing genius telling me how to do this. I designed the label myself. I designed the bottle myself. I designed the blue glass.
How surprised were you at the success of Sky? Now, at one point, it was one of the leading vodkas sold in the United States.
I was very pleasantly surprised, okay? I said, boy, I never thought it would be this hot or this terrific, because I didn't have the advertising budget and whatnot. I mean, this was done grassroots, and I must tell you that thank God we live in America. As an example, I mean, I wanted to go in the alcohol business. I went to the state, and I said, fill out this form. Have you been convicted of a felony? What is your mother's maiden name? $250. Stamp, you're in business now. Go. In Europe, there's no way that they would let me go into the vodka business or any alcohol business, okay?
You mentioned that your efforts were grassroots. What does that mean? What did you do in the early days to get Sky off the ground?
I focused on getting articles written in newspapers about my product. So all of a sudden, we got an enormous amount of free publicity, and it was true.
Also, Sky at one point had other products, had the distribution rights for third-party brands like Cuddy, Sark, Scotch, Whiskey, yeah. Molinet, Molinari, Sambuca, Campari, and Cinsano.
Yes.
To what extent were those, was that distribution agreement, how much did that add to the success of Sky ultimately?
It didn't add much to the value of Sky because those brands did not belong to me. But what happened was I got so big and I said I needed some guys who could help me run this business because I was working from 8 to 6, and this is too much, okay?
You mean 8 a.m. to 6 p.m.?
Right.
And that's a lot?
Every day. Oh, yeah. To me, that's a lot. Well, for an inventor, that's a lot. Anyway, I hired a couple of guys from Diageo, a big, big firm, okay? I said, take it over. And when they came on board, they were able to get, one of the brands was Campari. They said, come with us. We will really make sure your item is sold and shown and whatnot. So we got all these guys, small guys who were being sold by a big company. And we made a commission on every bottle that we sold. But the real business was Sky.
What part of your net worth was created by the Sky sale versus all the other products you've ever produced?
Well, it's probably the largest portion of my net worth, and probably 80% or... maybe 70%, but the largest portion.
There have been a number of products that you took to market that didn't work out, one of which was this drink called the 80-20 Cola.
Yes.
Which was a reduced-calorie drink.
I made a very big mistake with 80-20 Cola in that, and a young lady took me to lunch and took me to Burger King. What would you like to drink, sir? And I said, I'll have a Diet Coke. Okay. So he gives me the chicken tenders and there's an empty paper cup. I walked over and I said, Carolyn, look at this is America. Got regular Coke, Diet Coke, Sprite, Schmite, Dr. Pepper. We have a choice. It's wonderful. So I said, let me try this. I took about 20% of regular Coke and 80% Diet Coke, and lo and behold, it tasted like all sugar Coke. I said, this should be an item that could sell. And I got the name 80-20 Cola. Now, here's an instance where I did not do my homework. I thought on a six-pack, Coca-Cola makes a dollar. Turns out they make 12 cents. That's no market at all. Two, if we start really selling this at Safeway, we have no patent. Coke and Pepsi will make an 80-20 Cola. I said, this was a big mistake on my part, and I'm giving it up.
Even if they made an 80-20 Cola, your brand might
have
been enough.
By that time, it would be too late. I couldn't afford the advertising, and they would go to Safeway, and they would get a better position. I failed. I mean, I accept failure.
Incidentally, you talk about the importance of a name. You've developed a dental floss whose patent has run out. But one of the reasons you didn't ultimately try to push it to market is you couldn't come up with a name.
I couldn't come up with a name, right.
What was so special about this dental floss?
And I said,
floss?
Well, it's a film rather than a fiber. And it's a crumbled film that's very strong and has two advantages. One, it slides easily. And two, the fact that it's crinkly that way wipes the tooth better than a fiber. I use it myself, but I have not sold any. Somebody came out with a dental floss called Glide. And I said, if I had had that name, I would have gone in. So again, to me, a name is extremely valuable if you get the right name. It's still on the shelf.
One of your inventions is a Rollo cane, which is a three-wheeled cane to help people walk more smoothly.
I have not given it the time or attention that it deserves, okay? And because I can't find anybody to manage the business and I can't do it, it's on the shelf, ready to go anytime somebody wants to do it. And it's a terrific thing for people who need a cane, but this is an easy cane to roll. My mother used it when she before she died. But anyway.
What would you say you're most proud of?
Probably the needle protector, because if that saved one life, okay, from getting AIDS, I mean, we have an expression in Judaism, and by the way, it's Judaism, not Judaism, as most people pronounce it. In Judaism, there's, you know, he who saves one life saves the world. We have 3 degrees of charity. I don't know if you know this, but the highest degree is where the recipient does not know the donor, and the donor does not know the recipient. The second degree is where the recipient does not know the donor, but the donor knows the recipient. So the recipient is not always embarrassed every time he meets the donor. And the lowest form is he knows the donor and he knows the recipient. But there are 3 degrees of charity. So, of course, I mean, I feel very proud that, who knows, 1, 2, maybe 10 people did not get AIDS because of this invention, and that makes me very proud.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
My guest has been the inventor, Maurice Kambar. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.